Welcome, everybody. This is the third lecture for the Mises Academy class, Econ 730 for the Overachievers, Keynes, Krugman, and the Crisis. We are broadcasting here from Freedom Fest in oppressively hot Las Vegas, but it's a dry heat, so it's okay. And I think the internet connection is going to hold up, so this is good. Thank you, everyone, for accommodating my schedule because of my flight. We're starting an hour later than normal, but look, we still have a pretty good attendance right now, so I hope it didn't inconvenience too many of you. So why don't we go ahead and jump right in? There's a lot of material tonight, and what I'm going to be talking about, so this lecture in particular, probably more so than any of the other ones, well, except maybe for next week, or 2 weeks from now, rather, I'm going to be talking about a lot of stuff here that wasn't directly in the assigned reading, because you can't make sense of Keynes's overall worldview and the implicit policy recommendations in the stuff that I did assign, unless you know what he means by marginal efficiency of capital and what's going on with that concept and its relationship to the interest rate. But the problem is I didn't assign you guys that stuff, at least in the mandatory readings, because it's really hard stuff. So I mentioned to you, so let me just reassure you, those of you who are having difficulty with this reading, in case you're thinking like, well, I just must be an A because I don't know what Keynes is talking about. This is a lot harder than I remember it being. So if you recall early in the semester, whatever you want to call it for this course, I had mentioned to you guys that, you know, we're going to read directly from Keynes and don't worry, don't be intimidated. A lot of people say it's possible, but in grad school I went to read it and I thought it was okay. It wasn't a big deal. Well, this time around, I went to read it, and it's really tough for me. And I'll read the same paragraph three times sometimes. And so I don't know why that is. It's either, I think part of it is, in grad school, when I first read it, I had been warned by people that it was incomprehensible, and so I went in with that expectation, and then it wasn't as bad as I thought it might be. Whereas this time around, I remember thinking it wasn't that bad, so I went in thinking it would be easy, and now it's really hard. So that could be it, or just I've gotten stupid since grad school, and I can't parse things anymore. That my mind was sharper back then. That's also a definite possibility. Having a son and basically not being able to sleep for a year when he was a newborn, that may have just permanently damaged my mind. I don't know. So, in any event, I just want to reassure you guys, I'm having difficulty reading this, and I did a dissertation in this area. So this is difficult stuff. Say what you will about Paul Krugman, it's going to be a lot easier to understand what his argument is when we get to him in a few weeks. And that's partly why I love reading Krugman so much. He's very crisp. And then not only does he do the math and do the charts and everything, the graphs, then he'll come up with some clever, stylized example to illustrate the point he made. So it's pretty obvious what Krugman is saying, whereas with Keynes, sometimes you don't even know what the heck he's saying. You just know you don't like it. Okay, so again, I'm just acknowledging that I feel your guys' pain if you're having trouble. Nonetheless, even though I'm having difficulty this time around reading it, I do think that the guy is a genius, and I don't use that term lightly. So I don't think we're wasting our time by reading it, and I also understand why so many economists think he was so special. So there is a lot there. He had a lot of brilliant insights in certain areas. I just think he got off on the wrong foot and just went with it to the point of catastrophe. All right, so if you guys have done the reading, you can see the conclusions he reaches are just anathema to me, and I assume most of you. And so what I'm going to do in this lecture, lecture three here, is again, I'm not trying to convince you that Keynes is bad right now. I think, first of all, most of you probably already think that anyway, so I'd be preaching to the choir. But what I'm trying to do in this lecture, same thing I was doing last week, is I want you to understand where he's coming from. I want you to see the internal consistency or coherence in his worldview. So for a couple reasons. First of all, just to be intellectually honest, like if you're going to critique somebody, you should first make sure you understand the argument. But also, I think it might serve to make you get along with the rest of humanity better. All right, because if you think that the general theory is just complete bogus crazy talk, and that how could anyone possibly believe that stuff, and it's just full of idiocy, then the only explanation for why Keynesianism is so dominant is that everybody is just evil or stupid. And so that, if you walk around with that mentality, that's sort of, it's going to make you bitter. And so what I'm trying to say is, I don't think it's that bad in the sense that let me show you, try to get you to see how you actually honestly believe this stuff. You could think that Keynes really is a genius and that he gave a system that was more general than what the free market economists were working with, and that it's actually the free market economists who are dogmatic and refuse to see the truth. And then if you can click with it, so not that you agree with it, but if you can see how someone could honestly believe that, then you can understand why Paul Krugman is the way he is, right? Whereas a lot of people I know, they think that Krugman is either a moron or he's like sinister. He writes his columns and then goes, "Mwah!" And what I'm trying to say is, I think it's just possible that Paul Krugman honestly believes the stuff he's writing, and he thinks he could have 3% unemployment 6 months from now if only people would listen to him. And it's these moronic free market Chicago school and Austrian economists who just refuse to see the most elementary arguments and data staring them in the face because they have a fetish for gold, or they just can't stand deficits per se. Right, so I want you guys to see that so you can understand why Krugman would think that. Because then, like I say, it sort of diffuses your bitterness at the world. If you can just see, no, a lot of this could be that Keynes presented this pretty sophisticated framework, and you could be seduced by it and actually think it was right. Not that in other words, not that it's patently obvious that it's stupid or it's nonsensical, and so anybody who endorses it, it's just because they like government spending in the first place and they come up with a reason to justify it, or that they're completely dumb. Because it's Keynes and Krugman are not dumb. I mean, there's no way you can say that about them. And so what I'm saying is, if it turns out they're just mistaken, then it's easier to deal with reality and to get along with people and not just think it's all hopeless. Okay, so anyway, that's what my goal is tonight. So I'm not going to try to poke the holes in the Keynesian framework. I am going to do my best here to get you to see what Keynes is talking about, to at least understand the argument. And then next week, when we're talking to, what's that, week 4 of this course, is when we start dealing with Hayek, start reading some of his stuff. So at that point, I will begin to bring in for you guys the Austrian perspective on this, because, don't worry, I'm not sitting here thinking, yeah, this is all makes perfect sense. This guy Keynes is pretty sharp. There's, I think, gaping holes in his argument. It's interesting to, you can read the general theory, and if you didn't have an alternative framework or you just, you couldn't spot the fallacy, I could see how a lot of people get sucked into it. It's kind of hard to read the general theory cover to cover and not come away thinking, wow, that guy really, that's a breath of fresh air. He really took those classical economists on and, show the shortcomings in their views. And, we'll get into that. So for tonight's lecture, I am going to spend a lot of time talking about this issue of the marginal efficiency of capital, because it's such a key foundation in Keynes's system. But again, admittedly, it's a little bit awkward since I didn't assign this stuff to you guys. Now, if you want, by all means, read more from general theory than what I assigned. Let me just mention this right now. I'm not even putting this on a syllabus as even optional, because I don't want to overload people, because I think some people, even if it says optional, feel like, oh, Dr. Murphy wants me to read this, and I'm afraid if I assign 200 pages of reading, you guys are going to get burned out. So that's why I'm not even putting this up there, but I'll just say it verbally right now. I'm just looking up the right chapter here. So chapter 16, Observations on the Nature of Capital, or I think it's Sundry Observations on the Nature of Capital. He does a lot of stuff in there if you want to try to read it, but it's tough. If you're not getting a master's or a PhD in economics, you might not want to get into it because it gets pretty deep pretty fast. Chapter 17, Properties of Interest and Money. Again, if you want to read that, you're going to pick up a lot of stuff of his worldview, but it gets tricky too. And that, you know, chapter 18 I did assign to you guys, that was the general theory restated. What's actually pretty good is his notes on mercantilism. So that's chapter 23. I was just on the plane, I was reading that just because, and it's actually fairly lucid and relevant. In other words, I didn't even consider before assigning to you guys because what do I care what Keynes said about mercantilism, but actually, if you want to read more from the general theory, but you're getting scared away by when he dives into the real technical stuff, his discussion of mercantilists actually is pretty digestible if you don't have a formal background in economics. So again, I'm not telling you to go read this stuff. You certainly don't need to read any of this stuff for this class. I'm not going to test you on it. I'm just saying if you are intrigued and you want to read more of Keynes, but you look at some of the chapter titles into it and then you just started getting into equations and scared you away, the chapter, his note on mercantilism, actually is pretty comprehensible, and it'll give you a good idea of what Keynes thought his system's relationship was to the history of economic thought. So just to give you a little hint, Keynes ends up saying that, you know what, the mercantilists weren't as stupid as the classical economists told us they were, and humanity's long-standing tradition of trying to limit the rate of interest with laws against usury actually is justifiable. And again, in stark contrast to what the classical economists taught us. All right, so Keynes is actually saying that the classical economists, who basically told us the mercantilists were completely crazy, that it's never in a country's interest to interfere with free trade, and that laws against so-called usury, excessively high rates of interest, are also bad. Those are two contributions of the classical school that even I would call the classical economists, not just Keynes's term, guys like Adam Smith and Jeremy Bentham and so forth. Keynes is saying, you know what, I think they gave their predecessors a raw deal, that there's a lot of wisdom in the mercantilist writings, and even in like the scholastic churchmen's writings against interest and how do you promote the socially advantageous investments and so forth and give an adequate return to people who take risks and all that without allowing just pure money lenders to earn a rate of return on barren money. Right, so that's the sort of thing that the medieval church worried about. And one of the things of the classical economists that they did was basically say that's a bunch of hocus pocus, that the interest rate is just a price like anything else, and if you screw with that, you're going to mess up the economy. And so don't worry about imports and exports, don't worry about the trade balance, and don't worry about excessively high rates of interest. The interest rates need to be that high to promote savings and investment frugality, and everything's great. So that's boiling it down, but that's kind of what the classical school's legacy was. Keynes is saying, you know what, I think maybe that they're wrong there too. So anyway, it's an interesting thing, and just to show how much Paul Krugman is following in the footsteps of Keynes, because I don't remember off the top of my head if we have readings in this course that touch that aspect, but the thing that just blows my mind with Krugman is that he's not merely recommending big government deficits excessively low interest rates in terms of his policy prescriptions. He's also saying that even slapping tariffs on Chinese goods might be a way to get us out of the current recession. Right? So Paul Krugman, who won Nobel Memorial Prize for trade theory, is actually saying that mercantilism could make sense in the midst of a liquidity trap. And so what I'm saying, it's interesting that Keynes himself, not in those terms, but was saying the same thing back in the general theory, that even the classical wisdom regarding free trade is only strictly true when there's full employment, and if you don't have full employment, all bets are off. Maybe even protectionism could be beneficial within a certain range. So again, it's you see why Keynes called it the general theory. Let me just give you one more sort of big picture remark just to drive this point home, because I don't have a slide saying I mentioned it, of course, last week, but let me just say it again now. The big picture thing that Keynes thought he was doing, and I think he says it in the chapter where he says the general theory restated, but let me say it explicitly. Keynes is trying to say that all of the relationship among economic variables that the classicals look at can be defined with reference to or with respect to a given level of employment, which in turn fixes the national income. So you can have an equilibrium interest rate, equilibrium wage rate, equilibrium amounts of investment, and so forth, and resources going into various industries, certain portions. But the point is, Keynes is saying you can't just tell me in general what's the interest rate going to be, what's the level of investment going to be in equilibrium. You have to tell me with what percentage of the workforce working or being employed, because then those numbers can differ. So obviously, with 20% unemployment, national income is going to be lower, the rate of investment is going to be lower, the amount of consumption is going to be lower, and in fact, the absolute amount of savings is going to be lower. And then that can be an equilibrium situation. The economy could sit there perfectly stable for years with 20% unemployment. And all of those things are, and so the classical economists, their system is correct in terms of the marginal allocation of resources and what percentage of total income goes to the landowners, what percentage goes to the workers, what percentage goes to the capitalists, and the way the principles they use to determine that are all valid. But Keynes says the thing they overlook is they just assumed that there are natural forces in a market economy that would push it towards full employment, and then their system would kick in. And Keynes is saying, no, we have to be more general than that. You have to, the system could be stable at many different levels of employment. There's no reason that the economy left to its own devices is going to naturally gravitate towards full employment. In general, we actually wouldn't expect that to happen. So that's another thing, let me just point out, and I read it on the plane. I don't remember if it came from a chapter that you guys were supposed to read, but Keynes at one point says that throughout human history, the economy has only very rarely been at what he calls full employment. Right, so you might think that Keynes believed that, let's say, over a 20-year time span, that maybe the economy is at full employment for 14 of those years, and then the other six, it's a recession. And that's not what Keynes thought. Even during what we would call a boom, Keynes thinks that actually, no, that's not full employment. It's closer to full employment, but he thinks that, no, if we did things right and had the propensity to consume and the rate of investment, the rate of interest, everything the way they should be, that we would have much better utilization of society's resources. Okay, so just so you know that's where Keynes is coming from. So it's not that Keynes thinks market economies are okay 80% of the time, and he's just worried about how do we get them out of a rut when they fall into obvious recession. No, Keynes thinks much more generally than that. Even during what most economists would say is a healthy economy, that's not actually the case. Okay, so let me now switch to the slide here, marginal efficiency of capital. The definition. So this is what Keynes says in Chapter 11, which you guys weren't assigned, but Chapter 11 is talking about the marginal efficiency of capital. So here's the definition. The marginal efficiency of capital is, quote, that rate of discount which would make the present value of the series of annuities given by the returns expected from the capital asset during its life just equal to its supply price. All right, so that's pretty straightforward, isn't it? I think we can just move on. No, obviously not. Even as I was typing this, I wondered, should I even bother typing this out, because this is going to be incomprehensible to you guys. So let me try to paraphrase that, because again, this, the marginal efficiency of capital is central to the whole Keynesian worldview, by which I mean John Maynard Keynes' worldview. It's maybe not as important. Like, Paul Krugman doesn't talk about the marginal efficiency of capital. Okay, so Keynes is, so I'm looking at the next slide now in American English, please. So Keynes' marginal efficiency of capital, it's very similar, if you know what this terminology, to what accountants would now call the internal rate of return on a project. So the marginal efficiency of capital is always defined with respect to a particular capital asset. And if you know from accounting what we mean by the internal rate of return, it's pretty close to that. The only difference is, in standard accounting, when we talk about the internal rate of return, you're going to compare it with, you're going to use the purchase price. But with Keynes, you're not necessarily using the purchase price, you're using the supply price, which is the price of that capital asset that the producers would just need to make it worth their while to produce it. So in general, they might be able to charge higher than the supply price for the thing, but the supply price is saying what's the minimum the price could be so that it's just worth their while to go ahead and produce that particular item. Okay, so again, we're going back to the slide here. So the marginal efficiency of capital is the average annualized rate of return that a capital asset will earn over its life above the initial price that just makes it worthwhile to produce it, taking into account the cost of the operation and so forth. And so let me, I think the easiest way to get this point across is to give you an example. Okay, so I'm looking at, I'd see here the numerical example. So let's say there's a machine that if a firm gets it and adds it to its operation, so the firm right now doesn't have the machine. They have workers, they have some other equipment, the firm buys inputs, the workers use the stuff with the other tools they have at their disposal, turn it into output, and they sell it to their customers. And so they make a certain amount of net income from that. So now, if someone just donated this machine for free to the firm, and they, you know, brought it in, now they might, because their output might go up now, because now their workers are more productive using this new machine, maybe they also have to buy more inputs, right, because they're cranking out more stuff. So what I'm saying is, you take into account all that stuff, and this firm is saying the net profits go up $2,000 each year. So you're netting out the fact that you have to buy more inputs because now you're cranking out more stuff. So the point is, this firm, if somebody just for free gave them this machine, their net profits would go up $2,000 each year because they're selling more output, so their revenues are higher, and their other costs of production haven't gone up by as much, and so their bottom line improves by $2,000 each year. So that's how much that firm would be willing to pay to rent the machine, right? So if there's some other business somewhere and its operation is to rent these machines out, it could charge $2,000 a year to this first business to rent it, right? Because that's how much it increases the first business's net profit, all right? So now further suppose this particular machine lasts for 10 years before you just scrap it and you have to get a new one, and each year it requires $1,000 in maintenance. All right? So that $1,000 in maintenance, I wasn't counting that in the first paragraph. Okay, in the first paragraph, I was just trying to isolate the gross rental rate of the machine. Whereas in the second paragraph here, we're not taking into account, oh, wait a minute, the machine physically deteriorates when you use it. You have to oil it. You have to buy new ball bearings or whatever it is. All right, so you have to spend money every year just to keep the machine up and running. And that's in addition to the fact that if you use the machine, you're probably going to be increasing output, and so you're going to be buying more labor hours, you're going to be buying more raw materials because you're cranking up your output. Right? So the first paragraph is taking into account the fact that your other expenses might go up a little bit. Second paragraph is taking into account the direct expenditures on maintaining the machine. Okay, so what do we conclude now? So if you're in the business of having these machines and renting them out to other operations, you can rent them out for $2,000 a year, but then you also have to spend $1,000 a year to maintain the machines. And so what does that mean? On net, the net income generated by these machines is only $1,000 per year. Okay, now, and they last for 10 years before you just scrap them. You can't, it's not worthwhile to continue using them. You just scrap them and suppose there's no scrap value. Okay, so what that really means that is if you somehow magically in the forest came upon a brand new machine, given the market conditions right now, it would yield you a stream of $1,000 earnings for the next 10 years, per year for the next 10 years. So it's like you stumbled upon a bond that paid you $1,000 in cash every year for 10 years. That's what this machine is like. And now, one other piece of information. These machines, of course, don't just magically appear in the forest. Producers have to make them. Producers have to hire workers, buy raw materials, use other machines, and so forth in order to assemble these brand new machines. And in order to make them just willing to do that, on the margin, they have to charge $8,000. So that's the supply price of a new machine. And so now what do we know? We know that in order to induce a producer to make one of these new machines, I have to pay $8,000. And then if I do that, now I have a brand new machine, I will be able to rent it out or to use it in my own operations and earn net $1,000 per year because of it. Because what really happens is my business, everything else considered, my net income goes to $2,000 a year, but of that, I need to take $1,000 and pay for direct maintenance of the machine. So on net, the fact that I have this machine in my possession makes me earn an extra $1,000 per year for the next 10 years, but I had to pay $8,000 up front for it. So now the question is, what's the marginal efficiency of capital for this particular machine? It's about 4.2%. Because what that means is, what does the rate of discount have to be such that a string of $1,000 payments for 10 years in a row right now has the present value of $8,000? So, equivalently, if you had a bond that promised to pay you $1,000 cash every year for 10 years in a row, and right now the interest rate is 4.2%, the price of that bond would be $8,000. You would pay $8,000 to somebody who would then give you that bond, and you would earn, you'd get $1,000 payments over a 10-year period. So when all was said and done, after the 10 years, you'd have $10,000 if you sat on the payments and didn't do anything with it. And so that's so you're earning a positive return, and the point is it's 4.2% per year, okay? Okay, so the relationship to the interest rates, left to their own devices, investors will purchase new capital assets, moving down the schedule of the marginal efficiency of capital until on the margin it equals the money interest rate. Okay, so let me just go back to this one. So let's say with this particular example, this numerical example here, where we run the numbers and right now the marginal efficiency of capital is 4.2%, what if the rate of interest on money in this economy is 3%? What's going to happen? Well, obviously, investors, business people are going to borrow money at 3% and then use it to buy a machine because the rate of return on the machine is 4.2%, and they can borrow money at 3. All right, so they're, think of it this way, they can borrow $8,000 today, use it to pay producers to make them a brand new machine, and now they can use it to start earning $1,000 net per year, and that's less than they need to pay the person who lent you the money. Okay, because you're earning 4.2% in the machine, through the machine, but your cost of capital, financial capital, is only 3%. Okay, so when the rate of interest is lower than the marginal efficiency of capital, people are going to go into this. They're going to invest more and so forth. So now what's going to happen, though, as more and more people are doing this, there's a couple things. So whatever it is that this machine is making, let's say the machine is useful in making DVDs. Right? So now as more and more people are investing in these machines, so more and more factories that are in the business of making DVDs are getting equipped with these machines that makes the workers at these factories more productive. So now the future's output of DVDs keeps going up and up, because there's more of these machines now being made, and so the DVD industry is now more productive. So that means the prices of those things, those DVDs in the future now, is going down compared to what we thought before. On the other hand, the resources that are needed to make these machines are becoming scarcer. You know, some of the stuff, like labor, is pretty generic. You know, maybe anybody can be trained to make these machines. That's not a big deal. But if there's certain minerals, let's say, that you need to make these types of machines, well, if we keep making more and more of the machines, those things start, their prices start going up. So the point is, as you move along the supply curve of these machines, the equilibrium price is going to go up because the demand for these machines has gone up. All right? So that's going to push up this $8,000 number. So the first thing I talked about, the fact that DVDs are going up, are going down in the future, means that firms are not going to be able to make as much net income off of owning the machine. So the $2,000 each year, that number is going to go down. Maintenance costs might go up because the oil and whatever you need to maintain the machine, that if now you have more machines in operation, in existence, to be maintained, those prices might go up to do that. So that $1,000 might go up, and that $8,000 figure might go up. All right, so all those factors together are going to push down the marginal efficiency of capital. And so what's going to happen is people will invest in more of these machines until the point at which the marginal efficiency of capital is pushed down to the market rate of interest. And we're not worrying about risk, obviously, all right, that if you're borrowing money at a certain rate and you plunk it into this industry, I mean, you might say, on average, I expect to make 4.2%, but if you think it's really risky, then maybe you would need a higher amount. But my point is, abstracting away from risk, you can see how investors would keep investing in the production of more of these machines until the point at which the marginal efficiency of capital for that particular asset had been pushed down to the prevailing market rate of interest on money. And so Keynes is saying there's a whole schedule of the marginal efficiency of capital, and so we're just moving along it. And then that's going to be true for every asset. So So in general, initially the marginal efficiency of capital could be different on different physical assets, you know, on tractor trailers versus pieces of farmland versus fertilizer or whatever. But now, given that there's market rate of interest and investors are out trying to maximize their profits, they invest in the various lines, pushing down everything so that the marginal efficiency of capital is equalized. Okay. And this is obvious probably, but nobody is going to invest in something for which the marginal efficiency of capital is lower than the rate of interest. Because for one thing, if you already have the financial capital, if you've got $8,000 and you're trying to decide whether you want to invest it in something, and you look at the numbers and you can earn 4.2% by taking your $8,000 and paying someone to make this new machine, and then you rent it out to businesses that make DVDs, they pay you $2,000 a year, and then you pay $1,000 of it to maintain the machine, blah, 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 and you earn 4.2%. If the rate of interest is 5% on money loans, well, you'd be stupid. Why would you do that? You take your $8,000 in cash and lend it out to somebody at 5%. So you'd earn a higher rate of return. Okay, so the point is, in equilibrium, people are going to invest in physical things until the point at which the marginal efficiency of capital equals the prevailing market rate of interest. Okay, so now slide E, what would Keynes do? His recommendation, what he says the optimal thing to do, is that we should push down the interest rate on money loans to 0% so that capital accumulation continues until the point that the marginal efficiency of capital is itself equal to 0%. And just empirically, he thinks that could take about a generation, at least in modern economies like Great Britain or the United States. All right, I put that in exclamation points there just because I even on his own terms, I'm surprised he thinks that. Right, that he thinks, but hang on, let's just not get ahead of ourselves. So what is he talking about here? So this might be obvious, but let me spell it out. So Keynes is saying, look, the problem with the rate of interest being at, let's say, 4% is that it's an artificial break, B-R-A-K-E, an artificial constraint or hindrance on socially useful investment. That we want people to take their savings and to go spend it to give that money to producers to say, hey, make more machines. They'll make more machines, so they'll have, they'll be employed, they'll have an income, they'll make more machines, that will make the workers more productive, there'll be more DVDs, so our standard of living will be higher, and everybody wins. And so, what's the natural stopping point? At what point would we not want to do that anymore? Keynes is saying, well, you don't want to stop with a positive interest rate, because then that means there's a positive marginal efficiency of capital. But what does that mean? That means you could spend $8,000, for example, if the marginal efficiency of capital is 4.2%, you spend $8,000 in order to make a machine that over its lifetime is going to yield $10,000 worth of net consumption. Or net output, let's say. So there's a gain there, right? You keep pushing forward. Why don't we make more machines so that we increase the output of DVDs in the future? To the point at which, so you would only stop at the point at which there's more gains to be had, that you can't increase the standard of living anymore. Okay? I see somebody in the questions asking where the 4.2% came from. So let me just back up here. So we're looking at slide C. So what I did is I pulled up Excel, and I put in 10 rows of $1,000, and then to the right of that, I put in a formula that calculated the present value of that $1,000 if that payment came that many years in the future. So when I said 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, then to the right of that I had 1,000, and then to the third column I had a formula saying take that 1,000, then divide it by the interest rate raised to the power of whatever year it is. Okay, so you discount those things. So the first, so if interest rate's 5%, the first 1,000 is divided by 1.05. The second 1,000 is divided by 1.05 squared. The third is divided by 1.05 cubed, and so forth. So I did that, and then you add them up. You add those discounted figures, and so I had to just keep tinkering with what the interest rate was until that sum was roughly $8,000. Because with these numbers, this machine yields you a net income of $1,000 per year, and does it for 10 years. And so you have to adjust the rate of interest or the discount so that the present value, that stream of $1,000 annual payments for 10 years, has present value of $8,000. So that's roughly 4.2%. It's a little bit more. It's between 4.2 and 4.3. Okay? So that's where that number came from. Okay, so back to slide E here, what is Keynes talking about? So he is saying that if we're not concerned about property rights and that sort of thing, we're just thinking socially with the optimal amount of investment, he's saying we should keep accumulating capital until the point at which there's no more gain to doing that. And so what does it mean for there to be a gain? He's saying, well, basically, if we can extract more from the capital good over its life than we had to pump into it in the beginning, well, then it's still beneficial for it to exist. It makes sense for us to have created it, to have called it into existence. Because there's a trade-off. To make those machines, real resources had to go into them. You know, workers had to use their labor power to make the machine. We had to use whatever, minerals, other raw materials, and so forth. And then during the life of the machine, we also have to use scarce resources to maintain it. So those are definite costs that go into it. And then the issue is just, what are the benefits? And the benefits are the stream of net income flowing from the existence of the machine after we make it. And so Keynes is saying the optimal balance between those two things occurs when the marginal efficiency of capital has been pushed up to 0%. So you wouldn't want to accumulate more capital after that point, because in a sense you'd be putting more resources into making more capital goods that you then wouldn't recoup over the lifetime of those physical capital goods. But it does make sense on the margin, to so that when you say, hey, we could build another tractor, it's physically possible, we have the resources to do it, should we do it? Keynes is going to say, okay, well, let's look at what are the costs of all the resources going into making another tractor, and then over its lifetime, what are the benefits that are going to flow from it? And if the benefits exceed the cost, well, yeah, let's do it. And you might, so the market economy, of course, does that all the time. The individual entrepreneur does that when he says, the guy running a construction site can say, how many backhoe loaders do I want, or the farmer can say, do I want to go buy a new tractor? But Keynes's point is, what they do when they come up with that calculation is they have to plug in a rate of discount to be able to compare the upfront cost with the future benefits. And so they use the market rate of interest to put all those values into a common denominator, and that prejudices them against capital accumulation. That other things equal, the higher the rate of interest, the less likely you are to engage in investment spending. And so Keynes, it puts a brake on capital accumulation. So Keynes is saying that's artificial, that's just a social convention. The market rate of interest does not actually correspond to something real. if we could push it down to zero, then people acting in their own narrow self-interest would engage in further capital accumulation until we reach the socially optimal point. So let me just update the numerical example, and in case you're getting antsy and that's screaming out for a rebuttal, I'll come back to that in a couple of minutes. Well, let me just make sure you get what would happen in this world that Keynes is describing. Okay, so we're using that same numerical example from a few slides ago, and I'm updating it now. So suppose the central bank or whatever pushes down the rate of interest to zero, the rate of interest on money loans. So what happens before when the rate of interest, or sorry, the marginal efficiency of capital on that machine in that industry was 4.2%. So now if the money rate of interest is zero, people are borrowing money and they're using it to buy more of these machines, and then they're renting it out to the factories that use the machines to make DVDs. So I told you what's going to happen. One thing, now the quantity of DVDs being produced every year is going to go up. And so instead of being able to increase their net income by $2,000 each year, now on the margin, if they get one more of these machines, the firms making DVDs say that's only going to increase our net income by $1,950, okay, because now we have to lower the price of DVDs since we're making more of them. So that originally it was $2,009, went down to $1,950. The machine still lasts for 10 years because it's the same physical machine, but now to pay for the oil and the ball bearings and the mechanics to go around and service it, every year you have to pay $1,050 to maintain it because there are only so many people that were trained, let's say, in maintaining this type of machinery. And so on the margin, if now you've got a larger stock of these machines in existence, you have to offer a slightly higher wage rate to get more people to go into being mechanics in this particular area. And so on the margin, you're paying more. The supply curve of ball bearings is upward sloping. And so in order to get more of them, you had to pay a slightly higher price, so on and so forth. So it costs more to maintain these machines because now we're carrying, society is carrying a larger stock of such machines. Okay? So that's why that 1,000 went up to 1,050. And now also because drawing on the scarce supplies and so forth, the producers who make these machines, these brand new machines, they're still doing the same physical thing. They're still making the same physical machine, but now because more people have invested in them, since their orders went up, the output of these machines went up. Again, the supply curve is upward sloping for the industry that makes these brand new machines. And so in equilibrium now, instead of being $8,000, now it's $9,000 to buy a new machine. That just makes it worthwhile for the producers to crank out one more machine. Okay, so if you run these numbers, what's happening? Now, every year on net, the possession of one of these machines entitles you to $900 in extra income because you earn $1,950 in extra revenue, but you have to pay $1,050 in maintenance costs, so you're really only netting $900 per year, and that's for 10 years, and it costs you $9,000 up front to acquire the machine. So what's the marginal efficiency of capital? The internal rate of return is 0%. You pay $9,000 up front for the brand new machine, and then you reap $900 in net income from it every year for 10 years. So all you do is recoup your original $9,000. So you don't earn any net return on this machine. Okay, so that's why the marginal efficiency of capital is zero, but you're happy to do that or you're willing to do it because that's what the money rate of interest is. And so that's the idea. So we invested in these machines to the point at which we've moved down the supply schedule or the schedule of their marginal efficiency of capital until we reach 0% on the margin. Okay, now don't misquote Keynes. At times in general theory, he does say he wants to eliminate the scarcity of capital. In particular, in that last chapter, he says how right now the rentiers earn interest because of the scarcity of capital, but that's going to be done if we follow his proposals. And so there are some free market economists, like Don Boudreau recently said this, the guy who is, I think, the chair of the economics department at GMU. He recently said something along the lines of that, you know, Keynes was a utopian. He was going to abolish the scarcity of capital. And it looked like, I'd have to go reread it, but Boudreau may have been thinking that Keynes was saying basically the scarcity itself would be gone, that we would have so many tractors, we wouldn't want any more tractors on the margin. And that's not quite right. So, again, I'm saying in this slide, Keynes is a little bit sloppy. He does say at times he would eliminate the scarce capital, but by there he means the scarcity of renting capital, financial capital. So the price to rent money would be zero because that's what the interest rate is. The price of renting money, that would be zero, but it's not that capital itself would have zero scarcity. So if you borrow $10,000 from somebody, you would have to pay them back the $10,000. It's just saying you wouldn't have to pay them a premium over and above that. So it's still useful to have $10,000. It's not that financial capital itself is super abundant. It's just that it's so abundant, Keynes is saying, in his ideal world, you don't need to pay money to over and above to rent it out. Okay, so in particular, the physical machines, the physical capital goods, they would still have a positive rental price. So that's the, so make sure you get that aspect. So the machine, let me just backtrack one slide here. This machine here is still physically productive, even net of its maintenance costs and so forth. All right, that one way to think about it, if you were walking around in the woods and you stumbled upon one of these brand new machines, you would say, aha, great, this is awesome. You would pick it up and you would take it to the factory and use it, because then you would get an extra $900 per year out of it for 10 years in a row. So you would have stumbled upon something that was had a market price of $9,000. And humanity would be richer. If aliens showed up and just gave us a bunch of these machines, humanity would be richer. Our standard of living would be higher. Okay? Whereas if aliens showed up and gave us a bunch of cubic meters of oxygen, that wouldn't do anything for us, because air is non-scarce. It has no economic price. We don't need more air. Okay? But if the alien showed up and gave us these machines, even if the rate of interest is 0%, we're better off. The point is, it's good. It makes us richer if we just magically had more of these machines on the margin. So the machines are still physically productive, and they have a positive rental price. But the point is, it's not worthwhile for us to use our resources to make more machines. So if aliens show up and just give them to us, fine. But if we say, oh, well, if it's good to have more machines, why don't we make some more? No, because it takes $9,000 worth of resources to make them. And so, you know, that's just balanced right now. So we don't want to make more. Okay, so make sure you get that. Then Keynes at times refers to the fact that capital will no longer be scarce if we push down the marginal efficiency of capital to 0%. He doesn't mean the physical productivity of capital goods would be zero. He means their productivity over and above their cost of production is what he's getting at. Okay, and so this is when I was talking before, when I had those exclamation points, because this is what von Bavrick is talking about when he talks about the physical productivity of roundabout production processes. And I think von Bavrick would just be floored if he heard Keynes say that in a generation a modern economy could accumulate enough capital so that the internal rate of return would be zero. Because I think von Bavrick thought that, no, I mean, it's almost limitless empirically how much more productive you could make labor if you were willing to defer consumption. So in other words, instead of just having the workers directly make consumption goods, like DVDs, if instead we say, wait a minute, let's use our resources to make machines that will then augment our labor and other resources 2 years from now, and we'll make the DVDs then. And Mubarak said, you run that, you shoot your units appropriately, make sure you're doing it right, you will see that you can get more DVDs per unit of physical input, like per labor hour or per, ton of coal or whatever. If you come up with a way to do apples to apples and quantify how much physical resources are going into the production of DVDs, but Maverick's point is, if you are willing to wait for those DVDs, in general, empirically, you can find technological recipes to increase the physical output per unit of input. So if you need to have the DVDs next week, we don't have that many options. We got to just, use a certain amount of techniques that can give us the DVDs, and we can measure and say, per hour of labor, how many DVDs do we get? But if you tell me you can wait a decade, then here's what we're going to do. We're not going to use the same technique. We're going to first have the workers make some computers. We're going to use the computers to run engineering programs to try to figure out a more efficient way to make DVDs. We're going to do a lot of stuff so that 9 years from now, then we start getting down to the business of actually cranking out those DVDs. And then we have so many more DVDs that if you added all the labor and so forth that we put in during that decade, the amount of DVDs per hour of labor would be higher than it would be if we only had a week to work with. Right? So what Keynes is saying is just empirically, he thinks after a generation, like 25 years or so, of the rate of interest or pushing down the rate of interest and this capital accumulation, there would be no more scope for that sort of thing. That we would already have the largest capital stock we'd want to carry in every type of capital good, given our engineering knowledge. Right, so don't misunderstand. Keynes would still think if somebody came up with a new invention, or the physicist came up with new discoveries of how nature works, or a chemist came up with some new synthesized substance, that then our standard of living could go up. But the point is, our standard of living could not go up because of frugality and the accumulation of capital goods, just based on our existing technology. He thinks after about a generation, we would have exhausted all the gains from that. And I'm just saying, empirically, most Austrian economists would say, are you crazy? Okay. All right, how much time we got? Okay, we got about 17 minutes left, so let me just backtrack here to this what would Keynes do slide. Let me spend just a minute. Well, you know what? I'll go for it. Sorry about this. Messing around. I'm not sure just where to place these remarks. So now I'm looking at, for those of you who are listening in your car or something, I'm looking at the slide. Well, if you're listening in your car, I hope you're not looking at the slides. I'm looking at the slide, Roman numeral 2, socializing investments. So let me give the general picture here, and then I'll talk about the Austrian concerns with this. So Keynes says in that last chapter that it would require the socialization of investment. So let me just make sure you get why that's the case. So recall from last week's reading, I think it was from chapter 12. Let me just check. Yeah. So I gave you some excerpts from chapter 12 for last week's reading. And that's the famous stuff where Keynes is comparing Wall Street to a casino. And he's talking about animal spirits. He's saying how even if there are a class of investors who are very prudent and judicious and can make long-term forecasts and so forth, that for one thing, they're swamped by the morons who are just who are investing because they heard a good stock tip, or they just think it's fun and they want to be speculators and so on. And I said, for the other thing, even if you are a long-term investor, if you're playing for keeps, as it were, you make more money, or how can I put it? He has a famous thing where he says, I'm making these numbers up. If a stock right now is selling for 10, and you think that the fundamentals justify having a price of 20, you know, in terms of the performance of the company and the dividends they're going to pay and all that kind of stuff, and you think it's a sound business plan, they're going to be there for a long time. So you think that the stock really rationally ought to be valued at 20, and if we just wait long enough, it will be valued at 20. You might think that, oh, so you should rush in and buy it if it's only selling at 10 right now, right? And that would push up the price. But Keynes is saying, no, not if you also think that because of crowd psychology and what everybody else is doing, that the price of that stock is going to be $8 next month. You wouldn't want to buy it now at 10 if you think the price is going to be $8 next month. You would wait. Even though right now you think it's horribly undervalued relative to its fundamental price of 20, you'd wait because you think it's going to come down to 8 and then you'll buy it when it's at 8. In fact, if you held some of it right now at 10, you would sell it, even though you think eventually it's going to be 20. All right? So I see someone asking me about, I have my laptop plugged in. That's why I switched the lights over, so my battery's fine. Okay, so that's where Keynes is getting at. So in general, he does not like laissez-faire when it comes to investment decisions. Because first of all, he thinks that it's a casino. And what happens in particular with that marginal efficiency of capital, he thinks that during a crisis, when the economy all of a sudden flips from being in a boom to then crashing, he says that can happen very quickly because what happens is the marginal efficiency of capital collapses. Now you might wonder and say, well, how can that be? Because didn't that seem like a pretty mechanical calculation or formula? Then why would all of a sudden, so let me back up here for a second. On this slide, this first numerical example I gave you where we calculated the marginal efficiency of 4.2%, what Keynes is saying is all of a sudden it could be 4.2% today, then tomorrow the economy could crash and all of a sudden the marginal efficiency of capital on this machine could drop to 1%, just like that. Now you might say, how is that possible? Because isn't this just a formula? And you plug in these numbers, and how did those numbers change? Well, the machine's physical durability doesn't change, so it's still going to last for 10 years. The maintenance costs are going to be roughly the same. The supply price actually might even go down if, you know, unemployment goes way up and everything. But what's going to collapse is this first paragraph here, the estimation of the net profits accruing from ownership of this machine. Because that, even though it might have seemed like a formula, that is largely dependent on your views of what's going to happen over the next 10 years. Because what you're saying is the way we come up with this 4.2%, most of that is our estimates of saying what is the how much more net income am I going to get from owning this machine in year 1, in year 2, in year 3, all the way up to year 10, over and above the $1,000 maintenance costs. So if the economy all of a sudden you think is awful and nobody's buying DVDs, consumers stop buying DVDs because everyone's getting laid off and DVDs are an extravagance, so that's the way households cut back on their spending, well then you're not going to be able to rent this machine out to people for $2,000 a year. Those firms that are making DVDs are laying people off. All right, so the market price, the spot price of renting this machine might go from $2,000 down to $500. So you can see how the marginal efficiency of capital on this machine could collapse like that based on your expectations of what's going to happen in the DVD industry. Is that going to come back by year 3 or year 4? So if that happens, the marginal efficiency of capital drops from 4.2% to 1%, even if the interest rate goes from 4.2% down to 1.5%, it's still not going to stimulate investment because the marginal cost of capital is still going to be lower than the interest rate. All right, so that's why, now we're back to slide Roman numeral 2 here, that's why Keynes did not want to leave things to the market economy, because he was saying long-term expectation is a very fickle thing, partly for rational reasons, because there really is no rational way we can evaluate what the return to a machine in the DVD industry is going to be like 8 years from now. How the heck do we know that? Right, so Keynes is being realistic and saying that's a very dubious proposition. Right, so in that respect, just so you guys know, I'm going off on a little tangent here for a minute. That's why guys like Shackle, who, and even literally Lockman, who Lockman was an Austrian economist, or at least a fellow traveler, depending on how purist you want to make the definition, had elements of Keynesianism in them in this respect. And in fact, the famous book by Mario Rizzo and Gerald O'Driscoll, called, I think, The Economics of Time and Ignorance, that came from Keynes, the general theory, where he talks about we have to overcome the dark forces of time and ignorance. Right? So my point is, Keynes is by no means employing crazy mathematical models where we know what's going to happen 8 years from now. His point is, we have no clue what's going to happen 8 years from now. And so it's not surprising that businesses, business people's expectations of the future can radically change on the basis of just slight changes in the news. And so so because of that, the marginal efficiency of capital can collapse, and then there's no reason in a market economy that the interest rate is going to drop far enough to restore investment in these capital goods. And tonight I don't have time to get into it, but Keynes has a lengthy discussion about the things that prevent the money rate of interest from falling to the level it needs to reach. Not the least of which is the fact that the lowest it can go is zero, but Keynes thinks actually in a market economy the money rate of interest can't even go below like 2.5% for various reasons. Okay, so he wants to socialize investment because he's saying the market is wrong, that when confidence collapses like that and the marginal efficiency of capital in the DVD industry, for example, falls from 4.2% down to 1%, he said, you know, you don't want investment in those capital goods to be paralyzed, because then that's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. Then now, because no one's investing in those machines, all those workers get laid off, blah, blah, and then the pessimism that said, oh, man, maybe DVD sales are going to be in a slump for the next 10 years, well, if everyone thinks that, the market economy will actually adjust, and then we might be in a new equilibrium where that's true. That there's unemployment is 20%, so yeah, nobody's buying DVDs when unemployment is 20%. And then, so the people who said the marginal efficiency of capital instantly went from 4.2 to 1% would be correct. So Keynes is saying there's a way you can sort of jumpstart out of that if the government socializes investment and we just maintain accumulation of physical capital. And don't worry about the fact that the market economy, you know, speculators on Wall Street would have not been investing in things. We just say ignore that noise and say, no, we're taking the long-term view. Things will come back. Then things would come back because we as Keynesians understand what controls aggregate employment and output, and we can restore the economy if we just, you know, keep that level of investment spending up, right? So that's part of what's going on here. All right, now, let me, we got about 6 minutes left here, so let me just make two more points. I have one more slide, but I want to just mention something briefly. There is a problem, even here as I was trying to be neutral and just explain to you the Keynesian system, there's something screaming out for consideration, and that's time preference. Right, that how can it be that you can say the optimal state of affairs would be a situation where we had so many capital goods that had accumulated that on the margin it didn't make sense to make anymore. And again, it doesn't mean capital goods would no longer be scarce. It means it wouldn't be economical to make any more of them. Or rather, what really would happen is as they wore out, and we move a little bit on the schedule of the marginal efficiency of capital so that it became positive, we would make more and push it back down to zero. So we would just carry the same amount as they wore out, we would replace them, but we wouldn't accumulate any more on net. So there would be no net investment. There would just be enough investment each year to offset physical depreciation. So how do somebody like Mises or just any Austrian is going to say, Keynes, why do you think that's the best outcome? Or why do you say that it's right to go to that equilibrium? Because to get there means that humanity had to accumulate the physical capital, so they had to defer gratification. And so when society was producing those extra machines, those were resources that could have gone into current consumption. Right? Instead of producing more machines for the production of DVDs, we could have been cranking out more DVDs, or we could have been cranking out more apples, or whatever. So even though Keynes at times seems to not believe in scarcity, once we hit full employment, then the classical trade-offs kick in, remember, even on Keynes' terms. So Keynes understands there's scarcity. He understands there's a production possibilities frontier. His point is just that in general, in the real world with a market economy, we're very often operating within the frontier. But once you get out to the frontier and you're on it, then those trade-offs exist, and to create more capital equipment this year means you're creating fewer consumption goods. So, and Keynes acknowledges this. Let me see. I don't have it typed up here, but let me see if I can find it really fast. Okay, well, I'm not going to... All right, I'm not going to be able to find it right now. Keynes says something somewhere, like the only... he just has a few tantalizing hints that he gets this issue. And he says something like... Hang on a second, I think I know where it is. Give me one more minute, because I think it's in the last chapter. Yeah. Okay. So this is from chapter 24. It's at the end of the second section. Okay, so it says, if, however, it should prove easy to secure an approximation to full employment with the rate of physical capital accumulation not much greater than at present, an outstanding problem will at least have been solved. And it would remain for separate decision on what scale and by what means it is right and reasonable to call on the living generation to restrict their consumption so as to establish, in course of time, a state of full investment for their successors. All right, so what he's getting at there is he's saying, in order, depending on the numbers and how it shakes out, it's possible that to achieve full employment with, you know, having investment being at such a level of accumulation that every year we're cranking out more and more on net goods, physical capital goods, that we're making more than are being worn out. So this year we have a certain amount of capital goods, next year we have more, the next year we have even more, and so on. So that after about 25 years, we finally hit the point at which it doesn't make sense to make any more, even disregarding time preference. That just now to put more resources in to make another machine or more tractors or more backhoes or more buildings, we'd use more resources doing that, and we would recoup over the life of the machine, even using a zero rate of discount. Okay, so, but the point is, if we're doing that for the next 25 years, if we're plowing tons of our resources into making capital goods, so it's true, we have full employment, so it makes sense to do that to maintain full employment, but Keynes's point is, even so, the amount of consumption that we're going to get for the next 25 years is a lot lower than otherwise could have been had we achieved full employment by having higher consumption. And so Keynes is saying that's a separate issue. I can show you with my proposal how we could have full employment, we'd be on the frontier, and after about a generation, we would have reached the saturation point. The marginal efficiency of capital would be zero. And from that point forward, that would be the happiest, you know, we'd have the most productive economy imaginable given our knowledge of technology from that point forward. The question is, it would require sacrifices from the current generation for the next 25 years to get there. And so how do we solve that trade-off? Maybe it's better to accumulate capital more slowly so that it takes 100 years to reach that point of saturation so that the people over the next 100 years can consume more. So their standard of living is higher, and it just postpones the date at which we reach the best that could be hoped for. So Keynes is admitting there in that passage that that's a separate issue. So right there, that's an issue that, you know, Mises and others would talk about, is you're violating consumer sovereignty if you insist on pushing down the rate of interest to zero, that you're just ignoring the fact that people do have time preference, and that if the rate of interest in the market economy actually would be positive and you're just forcing it to be zero, you're overriding people's subjective preferences. You're forcing them to invest more, to accumulate machinery faster than they want to. And so it's kind of hard to justify that. Yeah, you're, you know, ignoring all the other problems. The next generation's better off. They're glad that we bequeathed to them this huge supply of tractors and factories and so on. But that's not what we wanted to do, and the government's forcing us to do it. So it's a little bit weird as to why Keynes is just ignoring that. Okay, last thing here, and then I'll stop. Last slide. Oops, not the last slide. This issue of euthanizing the rentier, that's just an issue of, I think I've talked enough about this. Keynes is saying if we push down the rate of interest to zero, nobody's going to earn a passive income from the possession of financial capital. And what else do we got here? This issue of, is Keynes a socialist or not? Well, he says things that are in conflict in the last chapter there throughout the book. So, yeah, he wants to socialize investment, and he's very comfortable with being an elitist and saying that he knows better how things should be invested than all those morons on Wall Street. All right, so certainly he doesn't have humility in that respect, and he's willing to impose his own views on things. But the way he conceives of what he's doing in chapter 24, he shows, is he thinks this is the only way to prevent the world from being taken over by dictators. Is he saying that the public will not tolerate, the workers will not tolerate prolonged periods of massive unemployment. So if we dogmatically insist on laissez-faire, then the workers are going to be seduced by totalitarian socialists who are going to say we can get rid of unemployment, and then that's that. Okay, so Keynes thought that he was saving capitalism. Okay, I see someone asking the question, how do you force people to save with a 0% interest rate? I realize I'm a little bit over time, but let me just, that's a good question, so let me answer that. We can count this as a preemptive or anticipation of the Q&A. So here's what Keynes is saying, and he gets into that in, in chapter 24 that I assigned. So it's an important component. Keynes is saying that what his theory shows us is the classical view of why interest is necessary is a reward for frugality. The people say, yeah, it's kind of unfair that the interest rate is 5%, and so that means some rich guy who just inherits a bunch of money can lounge around on his yacht sipping martinis, and he just earns an income from his possession of financial capital. He's not working. That seems kind of unfair, but you know what? We want to give an inducement for the accumulation of financial capital. If the interest rate were lower than that, then on the margin, people wouldn't have as much incentive to save, so the pool of real capital would fall, and then, you know, we wouldn't be able to invest as much. Keynes says that's balderdash, because he says it's almost like the flip side of Say's Law. Keynes at several points says if we're below full employment, the act of investment creates the savings needed to fund it. So you know how Say's Law was construed as supply creates its own demand? Keynes says that at least if you're below the point of full employment, investment creates its own savings. Specifically, what happens is when you invest more, that generates more income, so people consume more, and so incomes rise such that, given the propensity to consume and so forth, out of that higher income, enough is set aside to invest, or more is saved to justify the investment. All right, so that's what Keynes is getting at there. So he uses accounting tautologies to show that savings have to equal investment. But whereas the Austrians would say, right, so if you want to invest more, you first need savings, Keynes says it the other way around. He says, no, in general, when you invest more, income goes up, and so that gives people the ability to save more. Okay, so keep that in mind. Keynes agrees that in equilibrium, in the aggregate, savings always equal investments. But his point is that if people try to save too much and don't invest enough, then what happens is employment drops to the point at which out of that smaller amount of total income, now the amount being saved just equals the smaller amount being invested. Okay, so it's totally foreign to the way you're used to thinking of things. Okay, so this last thing here was Keynes an underconsumptionist. He's got different things scattered throughout the book that can make you think one way or the other. So when I say underconsumptionist, what I mean is this issue of, was Keynes really an apostle of consumption? Did he look at a market economy that was less than full employment and say, you know what? The problem is people are trying to save too much. The people aren't willing to consume more. That's really the problem. So like I said, I think last week, some modern Keynesian apologists say that's not true. Keynes wasn't saying people need to consume more. Keynes was just saying people need to spend more, whether it's investment or consumption. And what I'm saying to you now is it's pretty subtle. It's pretty nuanced. At times, Keynes does seem to come right out and say, the problem is people aren't consuming enough, and that's all we need to fix it. Whereas at other times, it looks like he's not quite saying it. So I can't give you a crisp answer. What I will say, though, is if you go and read, if you want, if you're curious, I'm not going to test you on it, but if you look at that stuff about his notes on mercantilism and so forth, I mean, Keynes does agree that the various underconsumptionist schools of thought had a lot to say for themselves, and he thought that their analysis was correct insofar as it went. But he just thought that they were overlooking the possible role of investment. Right? So in general, it's not correct to say Keynes just thought, the solution to a depression is for people to go out to the mall and spend more. But it's also true that if you don't let the government do various things, then Keynes would have thought, yeah, one way to get out of this rut would be if people were willing to consume a higher fraction of their income. Because ultimately the problem was people were trying to save more than they wanted to invest. And so one of the ways to get around that is if people just on their own for some reason decided to save less. But as far as what the government was going to do, Keynes had various recommendations. He wanted to push down the rate of interest to zero. He wanted the government to socialize investment, to get investment spending up to where it should be. And he also, though, wanted to have policies that redistributed income to raise the propensity to consume, that he wanted people to consume a higher fraction of their income than they would in a laissez-faire environment. And so he thought the government could play a role in, like, taxing the rich people, giving unemployment benefits and other subsidies to poor people to raise the propensity to consume. Okay, let me turn to your questions now. And unfortunately, my connection is really slow and it's freezing up here. Let me, since we only have 4 minutes left, let me just deal with some of the issues people are raising in the chat here, and I'll catch up with the questions you guys have posted in the forum in a minute, or not in a minute, but later on this week I'll get to that, just because my connection is slow and we're going to waste time trying to open that up. So let's see. Lori Miller says, wouldn't zero interest rates make people much less likely to invest and more likely to keep money in a mattress or gold or any other antisocial, in quotes, use? Well, I'm not sure what exactly he thinks is going to happen once we reach that point. But he, for one thing, he's not saying that the rate of interest would instantly go from 4.2% to 0%. He's saying that, no, over the course of 25 years, it could be pushed down eventually to 0%. Okay, so that's one issue. So he's, and again, the other thing is, and I would just encourage you just to reread that part. Let me make sure I'm pointing you the right thing. In chapter 24, which was assigned, so this part you do need to know. Right off the bat in section one there, in section two, Keynes is saying that it's not, well, let me just read it. So this is early on in section two of chapter 24. The justification for a moderately high rate of interest has been found hitherto in the necessity of providing a sufficient inducement to save. But we have shown that the extent of effective saving is necessarily determined by the scale of investment, and that the scale of investment is promoted by a low rate of interest, provided that we do not attempt to stimulate it in this way beyond the point which corresponds to full employment. Thus, it is to our best advantage to reduce the rate of interest to that point relatively to the schedule, the marginal efficiency of capital at which is full employment. Okay, so let me just paraphrase that, and then we'll be out of time. Okay, so what he's saying is, you're right, Lori. Let's say we're in the laissez-faire environment, and those interest rates, the marginal efficiency of capital has collapsed. We were in a boom period. It blew up in our faces, and now nobody's buying DVDs, so the marginal efficiency of capital in those machines that augment DVD production has dropped from 4.2 down to 1%. And the interest rate has also dropped from 4.2, but it's only dropped to, let's say, 2.5%. All right, so Keynes is saying, oh, this is awful. And unemployment is 20%. Keynes saying, this is awful. We need to, the central bank should come in and push down the interest rate, or at least down to 1%. Because right now, with the interest rate being 2.5 and the marginal efficiency of capital being 1, nobody's investing in these machines to make DVDs. And so that's making us poorer in the future, because now we don't have as many DVDs down the road. But also right now, all these workers who before making the machine were out of work, this is pure social waste. So, Laura, you're right. You're saying, wait a minute. Right now, if the market clearing interest rate is 2.5%, and we don't have enough, and people aren't invested in those machines, if we push it down to 1%, then who's going to be saving enough to make, provide the resources to crank out these machines? But what Keynes is saying is you're overlooking some things. So for one thing, right now, in this slump with unemployment 20%, there's not an inadequacy or a shortage of capital. It's not like the thing holding us back, that the reason the DVD manufacturers aren't investing in more machines is that people aren't saving enough. It's not that the economy is at the production possibilities frontier, and the only way to free up resources to make it physically possible to crank out more of these machines is if somebody somewhere cuts back on consumption to free up those resources. He's like, no, we have 20% unemployment right now. There's idle resources. We got unemployed guys. We have factories that are half idle. We could easily start making more of these machines without anybody reducing his consumption, because we would just be moving up and to the right in the production possibilities frontier. Okay, so the classical wisdom that you're using, Lori, thinking if we want to have more investment spending, consumption spending has to go down somewhere, and in order to get people to save more, we need a higher rate of interest, is wrong, he's going to say, because you're locked in the classical assumption of full employment. That specifically, if we're in that slump, the central bank pushes the interest rate down to 1%, now those firms can borrow at 1% and then pay the people to make the machines. And you might think, well, but something's got to give, right? Because now people are saving less. He's, you got people, if they had the same aggregate income as they did when unemployment was 20%, would be saving less. That's true, because the interest rate fell. But he's saying, but aggregate income is not the same. Now, unemployment, because we restore employment in the DVD machine industries, and then those people are spending more money and blah, blah, blah. If we restore full employment, now aggregate income is a lot higher. So even though people are saving a lower fraction of their income, the absolute amount of total savings is higher at full employment than it was at a 1% rate of interest than it was at a 2.5% rate of interest when unemployment was 20%. Okay, so let me just say that again one more time in different words. Lori, what you're worried about is the classical approach. It's, you know, and it's what Austrians talk about. When I write on stuff right now, that's what I use too. Right? So I'm not picking on you. You're espousing what a lot of us think of as common sense. You're saying, wait a minute, if the interest rate goes down, total savings goes down. How the heck can that promote investment? Keynes is saying, aha, see, you're stuck in just assuming that there's always full employment, meaning you're thinking of aggregate output and total income is given, but that's not true. If we boost investment spending, that restores employment, raising total output and total income, so that even if though people admittedly are saving a lower fraction of their income, because now the interest rate's lower, so it's true on the margin they have less incentive to save, nonetheless, because total income is higher, the aggregate amount of total savings is bigger than it was before, and in fact is just what it needs to be to match investment expenditures. It's that's the idea, and that kind of, in a nutshell, is what Keynes thinks is wrong with the classical school. He was trying to show that the trade-offs they had in mind, thinking that the only way you can get more investment expenditures if you cut back on consumption expenditure, is wrong. That's only true when you're at full employment. If you're less than full employment, Keynes says actually it's the reverse. The investment spending and consumption spending move together. Right? That there's not a trade-off. If you want to have more investment spending, you need more consumption spending. Right? That, think of the DVD example. The only way to get people to want to buy more machines to make DVDs is if the customers start buying more DVDs. You want your customers to start consuming more, to spend more money on buying DVDs, and then you as the business person say, oh, okay, now I have better forecasts about my revenue in the future, so I'm willing to spend the $8,000 to buy a new machine that cranks out DVD production in the future. So what was holding me back wasn't the rate of interest. That was nothing. What was holding me back was the fact that the demand for my product collapsed. And now I think that's coming back because people aren't so paranoid and now they're spending more freely in terms of consumption spending. Now I'm willing to go invest in that machinery. So Keynes' point is, when you look at that in the aggregate, it can be like a self-fulfilling prophecy. That if we all could just chill out and not be worried about the future and just spend freely, consume freely, then it would take care of itself. Whereas if we all, and this is what the paradox of thrift is, if we all clam up and say, oh my gosh, I'm worried about the economy, so I'm going to save my money, well, then if everyone's doing that, everyone's income collapses and the economy is awful. And it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy, and we can be stuck in that equilibrium. Okay, one last thing that I want to say, and then I'll have to stop because we're over time. You might say, wait a minute, this proves too much. If it's true that if we all clam up and start saving more than we were before, that can make the marginal efficiency of capital fall, that can lower investment spending, and then that causes a further round of pessimism, and why doesn't the economy just then just have these wild oscillations? Why doesn't unemployment go from 1% up to 100% and then bounce around like that? Why does it just kind of vary within a certain range typically? And Keynes does have an answer for that. It's in his notes on the trade cycle if you want to look at that. I think I made that an optional reading. Again, you don't have to, but if you want to see how does Keynes explain the fact that the economy oscillates in a sort of narrow range, that it doesn't go to massive full employment, but it also doesn't ever drop down to zero employment either. He has an explanation. And the other thing you could say is, well, if we get stuck in a recession or a depression, how does the economy get out of that, according to Keynes? Why aren't we stuck there forever? So in other words, if Keynes is saying the way to get out of a slump is for the government to promote investment spending or to promote consumption spending, to push down the rate of interest, how does Keynes explain the fact that market economies always did historically bounce back from crashes without intervention? Well, Keynes' answer is the physical wearing away of machinery is the way that it happens. So if the marginal efficiency of capital collapses, remember, use that example we've been working with, from 4.2 down to 1%, it's true. For a while, everything's going to shut down. Nobody's making more of those machines. And if the government doesn't do anything, you're going to be stuck like that for a while with high unemployment. But eventually, the machines in the DVD industry are going to wear out, right? They only had lives of 10 years. So eventually, those machines start wearing out, and the quantity of DVDs being produced shrinks, so their price goes up, and eventually the marginal efficiency of capital is going to go up and exceed whatever the rate of interest is. So if in a depressed state, the rate of interest had fallen to 2.5%, the point is because of even neglecting everything else, just the physical wearing out of those machines eventually will push their marginal efficiency of capital above 2.5%, and then once that happens, then it's a virtuous circle. Right now, because those firms start paying to get more machines made, that investment spending itself raises income, and it's instead of crashing, now we start moving back up, and so that raises income. Things start going, and so now people start buying more DVDs, and so it's the marginal efficiency of capital can keep going up and up, and then the rate of interest can also go up. So that's it. So that's how we get back to where we were, is that eventually the physical machinery wears out, and then there's scope for us to accumulate and so forth. Okay, so let me stop there. Next week, I think we get into what Hayek and others have to say about all this stuff. So I will send out an email. Your quiz, as always, will be posted by Friday. All right, thanks, everybody.